Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is the case of the state, or Roland Williams versus state. Mr. Williams was convicted at a first trial of delivery of cocaine, and pursuant to the habitual offender statute, he was sentenced under the mandatory section. He was sentenced to life in prison. His conviction was reversed in that case by this court due to an impropriety in the prosecutor's closing argument. The case returned to the Superior Court for a second trial, and at that time, the defense made a request, first to the Department of Justice and then a request to the court, that a different Deputy Attorney General be assigned to the case. And the reason for the request and the basis of our appeal and position today is that in the first trial, there were plea offers made. The defendant, my client, unwisely rejected them. But in the second trial, there was no plea offer whatsoever. And we understand and we concede, and it's well established, that the state has no obligation to make any plea offer at all. But the prosecutor has an obligation to act with fairness and without any bias or any conflict, and to discharge his discretion in a fair manner. And if not, then the defendant is deprived of his due process rights. Between the first trial and the second trial, nothing had changed. There were no new facts that came forward. The state all along knew what Mr. Williams' record was. There was nothing that had changed except that the conviction had been reversed on the basis of the prosecutor's argument. And as we explained to the Department of Justice and to the Superior Court, we believe that this presented a conflict or the appearance of a conflict. And that is the issue. Rather, there was, we believe, it created a conflict with this particular Deputy Attorney General.
Well, isn't the issue whether Judge Witham erred as a matter of law in not directing the Attorney General to reassign the case?
That is the issue, yes, Your Honor.
And your contention is that it was an error of law, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that Judge Witham...
My question is, what law?
Well, we believe it was an abuse of his discretion, that he had the discretion to do that and did not.
Well, when Justice Jacobs asked you what law, he means, where did the court get the power in the first instance to order a new prosecutor to be assigned to the case? You can't abuse your discretion unless you have the power to exercise it. What we want to know is, what is the source of the power of the Superior Court or any court to tell the Attorney General which prosecutor under what circumstances should be assigned to which case?
Well, the Department of Justice has that authority, but it is not without limit, and they're ethical. The judge could have, in our view, enforced the ethical rules that apply to all criminal cases. In this case, the ABA standards for criminal justice, the prosecution function and defense function, section 3-1.2. So it's not a law that the court should have enforced. It's the ethical rules and standards under the criminal justice standards.
Well, let's assume that there are standards of conduct that apply, and it would be preferable for the Attorney General to follow those standards of conduct. Again, the question is, in the event the Attorney General does not, what power does a Superior Court judge have to order the Attorney General to act differently and to comply with the judge's reading of those standards of conduct in a specific case? For example, here, it appears that the trial judge concluded that the Superior Court judges do have authority to reassign a deputy under circumstances that constitute a specific intangible cause. What is the source for that statement?
Your Honor, I can't point to any specific statute or court rule except the broad concept of due process of a fair trial for the defendant. I cannot cite a specific statute that gives the Superior Court that authority, but we believe they have broad authority to do what needs to be done within the Constitution and within the law. They are not prohibited from doing so by any law, and we believe the Superior Court judge has a broad authority and duty to see that the defendant is afforded a fair trial.
So you would point to some constitutional standard of substantive or procedural due process that would give the Superior Court judge a right to exercise discretion after determining that there's been a violation of, let's say, substantive due process?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it comes down to a basic constitutional 14th Amendment right to a fair trial. And it's certainly a broad application of that, but in some instances, and we believe this is one of those instances, where the facts fit the premise that there is a conflict here that has come about because of the facts of the case and the procedural history of the case, creating a conflict with the Deputy Attorney General that's assigned.
I'm having trouble with the term conflict. As I understand it, the prosecutor offered a plea before the first trial, which was refused.
Yes.
Mr. Williams went to trial and was convicted. It was reversed for prosecutorial error because of a statement this prosecutor made during the course of the trial. There was no plea offered the second time. He went to trial and was convicted by yet a second jury. And then the prosecutor exercised discretion to treat him as an habitual offender, which resulted in a life term, correct?
Yes.
Now, is the conflict the sense that the Deputy Attorney General was so tested by the reversal on prosecutorial error that he refused to offer a plea the second time when another prosecutor might have done so? Is that the essence of the conflict?
That is the essence of it, Your Honor. Now, we never can know what's going on in another person's mind or what their rationale is, and the prosecutor is not required to tell us why they offer a plea or don't offer a plea. Well, so we don't know what's in their mind, but there certainly is a arguable idea here that any lawyer who's told by the Supreme Court that they made a mistake, anyone, depending on their temperament, would be anywhere from chagrined to upset to angry.
Is your position that there was an actual conflict, however you define it, or merely an appearance of a conflict?
I believe there was an actual conflict because of the fact that we received no plea offer in the second case. I think that shows that there was a conflict.
And the actual conflict is that this prosecutor was badly motivated.
Yes.
Why wouldn't we infer just as likely that the prosecutor offered a plea in the first case before it went to trial for the first time with the thought in mind that he might lose the case on the original charges? But once he won it, even though it was reversed, he declined to offer a plea the second time because he figured he could win it the second time before. Why do we have to infer it your way? Why isn't it just as likely to refer it along the lines that I just suggested?
Well, in this particular case, I don't think that conclusion would be warranted because the facts of the case were pretty strong for the state right from the beginning. They had a willing witness who was able and willing to come in and testify and did so twice. To the best of my knowledge, never failed to appear or gave the state any difficulty that I know of. I believe they had a strong case right from the beginning. I don't think anything happened between the first trial and the second trial except the reversal of the conviction.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Dean. Is it your position that any time there is a reversal of a conviction because of prosecutorial misstatements to the jury, that the that unless the Attorney General assigns the case to a different prosecutor, that there is a due process violation if the original prosecutor takes the case to the second trial?
I believe it would be a proper and better policy for the Department of Justice to assign a case to a different prosecutor when it's been reversed because of the prosecutor's error.
But we're not here to talk about whether it would be proper policy or better for the Attorney General to do that. The question I'm asking is whether there's a due process obligation on the part of the Attorney General to reassign in those circumstances.
Yes, we believe there is. Under those facts and those circumstances, we do believe that, because regardless of the thought process and the motivations of the particular deputy, there is certainly the potential and the possibility and the probability of some conflict arising in his or her fair treatment in the second case. Now, if the court has any other questions, I don't really think I have anything to add. That is the heart of our argument.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May I please the court? I've asked Mr. Kreiner, who was the trial prosecutor, to be present today if the court has any specific questions that aren't of record that they might wish to ask the prosecutor. The single claim that's presented in this direct appeal is whether the Superior Court judge abused his discretion in denying Roland Williams' pretrial motion to require the Department of Justice to assign this drug delivery prosecution retrial to a different prosecutor. The reason for the defense request was that while Williams's attorney now wanted a plea offer of 10 years or less, no plea offer was made after the July 2002 reversal by this court after the first trial. Williams has cited no specific reasons apart from the reversal of the first conviction for the improper prosecutorial closing argument comments to attribute any impermissible bias or prejudice to the original trial prosecutor, who was also the prosecutor on the retrial. Even if Williams could identify some palpable prejudice or impermissible motive, the mere assignment of another prosecutor would not necessarily ensure that Williams would now belatedly accept a plea offer if one was even tendered. Criminal defendant has no right to compel a plea offer under these particular circumstances. And absent a showing of some particularized prejudice or a course of unfair dealing, a criminal defendant has no right to attempt to choose his prosecutor. While Williams's contention is speculative, it's not as outlandish as I guess some have argued. The Chevelle Washington case, which was decided by this court after the briefing, in that case, what the defendant was attempting to do was accept a plea offer that he had rejected prior to trial, gone to trial, been convicted, and then for some reason suddenly wanted to have a case review after he had already been found guilty. This court rightly determined that that was meritless. I don't think the contention here is that far-fetched, but I think it is equally meritless given the circumstances of this particular case.
Maybe you can help me decide how to handle the Superior Court's comment that it did, meaning a Superior Court judge, does have the power to order an Attorney General to reassign a deputy where there exists specific and tangible cause. What is the source for that power?
Well, I heard the similar question asked at the beginning of this oral argument.
I ask it because your briefing suggests, as your opening comments did, that this is an abuse of discretion case. Is it really?
Well, Chevelle Washington talks about abuse of discretion, and I think both parties have argued this is an abuse of discretion case. I think, though, if you're looking for the genesis of the power, it has to be in the substantive due process rights. And that's what some of the other cases, particularly the U.S. Supreme Court cases that talk about plea bargaining, speak of. They say when there's a example of vindictive prosecution, that is a due process, constitutional due process, right? And the normal standard of review for constitutional violations is legal error here.
Well, what concerns me is I can understand concepts of abuse of discretion when a trial judge refuses to accept a plea or refuses to schedule a case review or refuses to resentence or refuses to do something that's clearly within the power of the court to entertain. But reassignment of a deputy on any basis, what is the source of that power?
Well, I guess the power would have to be in the due process clause.
Well, isn't it really an indirect source, that is, assuming that there's some proper cause, as Chief Justice Steele asked, I would assume that if the facts are egregious enough, the Superior Court could actually rule that that particular prosecutor would not be permitted to try the case in that court, that is, to remove that lawyer from the case, as distinguished from telling the Attorney General to assign someone else.
Well, I think however you do it, you probably reach the same result, but I think you could certainly do that.
But in one case, the source of the power is the inherent authority of the court to control its own process and the ethical behavior of the lawyers that appear before it.
Correct.
That's different from due process. I mean, the two may intersect at some point, but it's a different notion.
Mm. No, I agree. I think that's very true. I think however you approach it, though, you're going to end up with a different prosecutor, and that's what Williams wanted. And his hope was that if he had a different prosecutor for the retrial, that perhaps then he would be extended a plea offer.
Well, Chief Justice Steele asked what the trial court might have meant by that somewhat cryptic sentence in the opinion. Could the trial judge have been referring to the case where where a pattern of ethical misbehavior by a prosecutor, and I'm not talking about this case, might compel the court, using its supervisory authority, to disqualify a particular prosecutor?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. I mean, I don't
want to
speculate too
here.
Much about what the trial judge was thinking, but I think it could certainly be that, or it could as well be just a generalized due process notion, because I know some of the federal cases at least have talked about a due process violation when you can demonstrate a vindictive prosecution, for example, that due process does seem to come into play there. However, here we don't have that requisite showing. We don't have any showing of vindictiveness on the part of the prosecutor. That all that happened here was, as was rightly pointed out, Mr. Williams was offered a plea, in fact, two pleas before his first trial, rejected those pleas, went to trial, and then the question was asked in argument this morning about what was different between the first case and the second case. Well, what was different was that Mr. Williams had testified at the first trial, and the state not only had convicted Mr. Williams on the basis of the evidence, but they also knew what Mr. Williams's claim was going to be in terms of his defense. Under those circumstances, I think there's certainly no reason that a prosecutor, any prosecutor, whether it was the same prosecutor or a different prosecutor, would see any compulsion to offer a particular plea. If the plea bargaining process and the case review process in the trial court is going to work, there has to be some incentive for the criminal defendant to accept the plea at the earliest opportunity. If the defendant doesn't do that, then there has to be some consequence in order to make the plea bargaining process and the case review process meaningful and to assist the trial court in the management and control of its own docket. that's all that occurred in this particular case, and there's nothing that has been identified in the briefing or in the argument before the trial court or in the argument today that shows any definitive prejudice on the part of the prosecutor. All we have is an assertion that there would be an appearance of impropriety because this particular prosecutor was reversed on a plain error claim on direct appeal because of comments in closing argument.
The assertion now seems to have been transmuted to a substantive conflict rather than an appearance of a conflict.
Well, I think that may be how it's argued, but I think all you really have is an appearance. That was the contention in the briefing, that it just would appear that you would have a conflict. There isn't any evidence that he had any particular animosity to Mr. Williams as opposed to anyone else, and there's certainly no assertion that Mr. Williams is somehow being treated differently than other like-situated individuals, which is the kind of scenario where you have concerns about vindictive prosecution. There's no allegation that any impermissible factor was being considered here. And the ultimate authority for offering pleas does rest with the prosecutorial authority in this case. Here, I think all you have is speculation and inference, and that simply is insufficient to require the removal of a prosecutor for a retrial after an appellate reversal here. Normally, you want the person who tried the case originally to handle a retrial because that's the prosecutor who's most familiar with the case. The person has hopefully established some rapport with whatever prosecutorial witnesses are required. In this particular case, there was a civilian witness, a Mr. Scott, who was the actual purchaser of the crack cocaine, and he was going to be needed for a retrial. So I think under those circumstances, just purely the economy of how you operate the office and not having people have to get up to speed on an entirely new case, is that the matter would routinely just be returned to the same trial prosecutor. Hopefully this would be a lesson that you could learn and not repeat the mistakes that caused the first reversal, that it's an opportunity for the prosecutor to learn by mistakes, and that's certainly something we're always striving for. So I don't think rather than connoting any type of impropriety here, I think it's simply good office practice, office management. It'll certainly lead to as expeditious a result in the retrial as we can hope for. And this is an individual that, is facing serious charges because of his prior record here. He was facing sentence as habitual criminal under subsection B. So I think under those circumstances, leaving the case with the original prosecutor was an appropriate way to handle the matter. If there's any additional questions from the court, I'll certainly try to answer those. Thank you very much.
A couple of comments that came to mind. I don't know how we would ever be able to prove actual unfairness in prosecution without knowing the internal workings of the mind and procedures of the deputy. It's just, in the briefing, we have focused on the appearance of a conflict, and we believe there was a conflict, but can we prove it? I just don't know, because we don't know what the mental processes were of the prosecutor in the second case. As far as anything different happening between the first and second trial, I believe it was not anything different. In the second trial, the state used Mr. Williams' first statement to impeach him in the second trial, and that actually probably worked to their advantage if they needed an advantage. The case was strong for the state in the beginning. A year or two before this case, I had another case that was reversed by this court. I've been sitting here and I can't think of the defendant's name. He was sentenced to mandatory life. This court reversed his conviction. We went back for a second trial, and I received a plea offer of either 10 or 12 years. And the defendant immediately accepted it, although he had rejected in the first place. His eyes had been opened, and he realized what he was facing. So in looking at the overall fairness of the process, we have to also look at the fact, in the in the prosecutor exercising his or her discretion, I'd rather this person actually deserves to be in prison the rest of their life.
Thank you, Ms. Dean. Thank you, counsel.
Please rise.